We're going to continue from where we left off. Last week, if you were here last week, then you remember there was a question that was posed by a lady who read a verse in the Bhagavatam about the female consorts riding with their husbands in their Vaikuntha airplanes. And it seemed to her that the women were given an inferior role, according to the verse of Bhagavatam, or maybe seen as less than the men in some way, even as second-class citizens. And so she was concerned about that, and so she wrote a letter and said, how do we understand this? How do we deal with this? And is this not reflecting some kind of prejudice that's prevalent in the material world? And we see it right in the Shastra, and it's describing the spiritual world. So how do we deal with this? And we're reading a reply by Ramapada Swami, and the first thing he said was, we can't look at the spiritual world from our conditioning in the material world and our biases, which we've obtained because of what goes on here and how women are treated or have been treated. So that's what we've got so far, and we're going to continue reading from there. So he's sensing that the woman who wrote this has a conception that spirituality would mean that everybody's equal on every level, in every aspect, in every way, and dealt with equally, treated equally. And so he's addressing that. And I want to welcome Patrick Manjesh and who else? And Patrick and Manjesh and Kremlin, our old faithful from Texas, and all the others we have not seen yet who are out there. If you would like to join us, you can go to chat. You see chat under my picture, and then you can join and you can take part in the conversation. A lot of questions and discussions go on chat. And if you have any comments you'd like to make or questions to ask, that's the way to do it. Okay. Kremlin says howdy because he's in Texas. And if you're not from Texas, I have to translate howdy. You probably know what that means, but it means hello, how's it going? If you're not from America, it probably sounds pretty funny. So, there is no claim of artificial equality in the spiritual world in some sense of utopian uniformity. The equality lies in the fact that everybody is engaged to their full capacity and full satisfaction in the service of one supreme enjoyer. Lord Krishna, spiritual communism, as Prabhupada would say. One in a subordinate position does not feel belittled or deprived in some way compared to a direct servitor of the Lord, nor does Krishna make such distinctions. Rather, in Vaikuntha consciousness, one prays to be servant of the servant of the servant many times removed. Such a position is more cherished than even direct service to the Lord. So she was feeling that the women were put in an inferior position. And here Maharaj is saying that the more inferior the position, at least in the spiritual world, the greater the position of the devotee. The more the devotee is the servant, the greater his or her position. And the devotee actually wants to be the servant. That's their highest aspiration. To be small, not to be great. And it is not in anyone's aspiration in the spiritual world to outdo anyone else or to be equal to anyone else, because everyone's position is already perfect. It's constitutional, it's eternal. It's not like the material world where they're in some way jealous of another's position. There is a sense of jealousy in the spiritual world, but the jealousy is not material and it enthuses their bhakti. So they become jealous of another devotee's service and they want to increase their service. They don't want to bring that person down. They don't want to defame that person. And they don't want to take that person's position. One in a subordinate position does not feel belittled or deprived in some way compared to a direct servitor of the Lord, nor does Krishna make such distinctions. Rather, in Vaikuntha consciousness, one prays to be a servant of the servant of the servant many times removed. Such a position is more cherished than even direct service to the Lord. For example, the Manjaris in Vrindavan, whose service it is to assist the gopis, do not feel inherently inferior in some capacity, nor deprived of Krishna's direct attention. Rather, they enjoy greater bliss in enhancing the service of the gopis. So this is not something we really have much experience of, but you may or may not know that there are gopis who don't serve or interact directly with Krishna, but they assist other gopis who interact directly with Krishna. And so from the material point of view, that seems to be like they got a raw deal or something. You know, they don't even get to have a direct relationship with Krishna. But it's not their service, and it's not what they want. And if Krishna would try to enjoy with them, they would say, "Don't touch me. I'm not your property. I'm the property of Radharani. I'm the property of this gopi, and you can't deal with me." That's their eternal position. So, of course, from the material point of view, it may not make sense. So we have to understand it from the spiritual point of view. And from the spiritual point of view, it's explained that they are called manjaris because on a plant, a manjari is part of the plant. So the gopis are enjoying, and the plant, or the manjari, is also getting nourished. So you could say the gopis are like the trunk of the plant or the main branch of the plant, and the manjaris are getting nourished by serving the gopis. And they're experiencing the same ecstasy, or maybe even sometimes greater ecstasy. So that's a whole different way of looking at a relationship. But this is transcendental, and we can't look at it from any material way. So, the gopis are very eager for Radha to meet Krishna, and Radharani in turn is eager to arrange the gopis' meeting with Krishna, and so on. Although by material yardstick, a bumblebee is not considered highly attractive, in Vaikuntha, the cuckoo birds admire the song of the bumblebee. Thus, the real basis of no distinction lies in the fact that there is no envy or exploitation in the spiritual world, not that there are no hierarchies and categories. So this is a wonderful point. So Sylvia is saying, well, it seems like the women are in an inferior position. And so Maharaj is making the point, it may seem that way, but there's no exploitation. There's no control by so-called superiors. It just doesn't exist. And so in that sense, there really is no superior and inferior position. There's only everyone in a perfect position, in their eternal position. And if you went to those women and said, well, wouldn't you like to be the boss? They would say, no, it's not my position. Or would you like to be in another position? They said, no, it's not my position. If a soul by constitution has such a disposition of assisting their male counterpart in service to Krishna, they are provided with a suitable female form. There is no denigration in this. The material world is simply a perverted reflection of the spiritual world. Thus, the categories and hierarchies we find here also exist in the spiritual sky, minus the inebriety found in this realm. The reflecting surface that perverts everything in this world is the desire to enjoy and predominate. Here, those who have male bodies want to enjoy and thus exploit the female form rather than perform their designated service of offering protection. Likewise, those with female bodies also want to enjoy and thus rebel against their subordinate position. The solution lies not in reversing the exploitation sequence by asserting oneself as equal and merging their respective roles, but in transforming the consciousness of both parties from the mood of enjoyment to service. The spiritual archetypes portrayed in the Bhagavatam, whether they are that of male, female, bumblebee, or lotus flower, highlights this perfection of the mood of service. So then, you know, you might think, wow, this bumblebee really got a raw deal, because in Vaikuntha they're just a bumblebee. Maybe they could have been a queen in a palace. So that's not fair. But we can't look at it that way. And neither does the bumblebee think it's not fair, because that's their constitutional position, their eternal service within the leelas and pastimes of Krishna. Of course, there is some sense of some freedom to go higher, but the general idea is that one's constitutional position is satisfying. So it's not even seen as a bumblebee or whatever it is, but it's a spiritual form, which is Satchit Ananda, and everyone's form is Satchit Ananda. So in that sense, everyone is the same, because their bodies are composed of the same substance. But the relationship they have with Krishna and the service they have with Krishna is specific to that individual soul, and it's perfect. And nobody is unhappy about it. As in the material world, not as, but in the material world, so often we are made unhappy about our position simply because someone has a position, a better position than ours. And we may be satisfied in our position, but because of jealousy or envy, or perhaps that we're being exploited by others, then we become jealous of another person and we want to be in their position. So it can disturb our own sense of satisfaction when we see another one in a superior position and we become jealous of them. So, you know, in Vedic culture, you have what's called the Varnashram system. And in the Varnashram system, people work according to the qualities that they have acquired, either by birth or acquired through education, and they're connected with those qualities, and their work is in accordance with those qualities, so they're satisfied with it. They understand, I'm working according to my nature. Just like you have the priests, they're called Brahmins. So they're given the highest respect in Vedic society. And so then you might think, well, what about the Shudras? Shudras are considered the lowest. So you might think, well, I don't want to be a Shudra, I want to be a Brahmin, because that's higher. So in one sense it's higher, but just like Arjuna, like Krishna told Arjuna, don't try to do another's duty. According to your nature, you do work. And then if you accept that, then you're happy, you're satisfied. Well, this is my nature. By nature, I'm a Shudra. And a Shudra is one who's happy serving others. That's their function. I mean, they may serve in different ways. It could be artists, could be musicians. Even they take part in military activity, but they're serving the warriors. So they're serving the other military men, the real military men, the Kshatriyas. So when one is identified with their nature, they become satisfied. So you see the same thing within Vedic culture. Women identify with their nature. They don't try to take on men's nature. So they become satisfied serving according to that nature. But in our culture, because they're not taken care of, then sometimes or often what happens is they're not satisfied with that nature, so they take on a more of a male nature. But they're not really, generally, they can't really be satisfied taking on that role, because it's ultimately unnatural. So in a healthy society, women can take on their natural role and be happy. In an unhealthy society, they may not be happy taking on that role, or often they're not happy. Not all of them, but some of them are not. This morning I was reading everything many things Prabhupada said about money, and one of the realizations I had is that although the principles are eternal, the practice or application of the principles are much more difficult to apply within our current day social system, but they're very easy to apply within the Varnashram system, because there was a whole structure to support a financial philosophy where Brahmins, whatever money they have, they spend on spiritual projects, and they never have any money at the end of the day. They always remain poor. But the society would never allow Brahmins to go hungry, so they could do that. and people didn't live extravagantly. And the Shudras would be maintained by the other classes within the Varnashram system. So they didn't really have to worry about money. And they would live simply and be happy. So you see, you needed a context in which the spiritual content or philosophy, economic philosophy, can work. So in the same way, you need somewhat of a social structure that's similar to the Varnashram structure to understand the roles that people take and how they could be happy within those roles. Otherwise, it just seems like exploitation. You know, look how they're dealing with women. They're not giving them the same opportunities that men have, or they're belittling them. But that's not really what they're doing. And it's not within that social system. It's not that the women want to outdo the men. The women have their place. The men give them their place, and they're happy in that place, and they can exert their influence in that place. And, you know, it's said that in these kingdoms, these great kingdoms in Vedic times, the women were running the kingdoms. You know, the men may be out fighting and negotiating with other kings and so forth, and the women are, you know, taking care of what's going on in the palace. So they did have a lot of power and a lot of influence. Okay. So, not to speak of the Vaikuntha planets, even within this world, there are illustrious examples of this paradigm in the Vedic culture. Paradigm that we're talking about, that people are satisfied in different situations. We do not find that powerful personalities such as Queen Kunti, Draupadi, Devahuti, or Archie, the consort of King Prithu, were contending for equal rights and opportunities. Although in one sense they did enjoy equal footing with their respective husbands, they happily, willingly, and gracefully accepted their roles as a dependent and subordinate, and as a fortress of support to their husbands. In other words, their husbands needed them in that role. That helped their husbands. It helped the kingdom. It helped the citizens. So naturally, they didn't want to disturb that peaceful environment that they can create, or that they not can create, that they did create, on the plea of, I'm becoming a second-class citizen, I'm being exploited, I have no say, and so forth. They understood their position, and they understood how it helped in the overall scheme of things. Welcome, Bhakti and Carol. Where have you been? We were missing you. Bhakti and Carol, you're always early. What happened? These ladies were fully content doing their specific services. That's a tongue twister. These ladies were fully content doing their specific services. Each of them also faced uniquely difficult challenges in their roles as wives and queens, which they faced very competently. They were grateful for the protection offered by their respectful husbands and by the society. They want to be protected by the husband because they need that, they require that, and it helps them deal with the difficulties that they're going through. So they had so much support from these great men. They were grateful for the protection offered by their respectful husbands and by the society. In turn, their exalted husbands were equally grateful for their extraordinary sacrifices and services. There was no sense of domination or exploitation, nor was there an artificial attempt at sharing of each other's roles. The husbands saw themselves as humble servants of the Lord, playing their part as a husband in extending to their wives the protection of the Lord. Thus they perfectly complemented and enhanced each other's service to the Lord, who alone is the supreme master and maintainer of everyone. I think the important point here is that they perfectly complemented and enhanced each other's service. So there's this, with man and woman, there's this synergistic effect, because the man has a certain nature which allows him to do certain things or be expert at certain things. The woman has a certain nature which allows her to do certain things and be expert in certain things, which the men naturally wouldn't want to do or couldn't do. And so the two combined become better than the individual parts. But if they try to... Here's another point. Even if the woman could do something better than the man, or the man could do something better than the woman, generally they wouldn't do it, because it was out of if it were out of the role, the male role or the female role, they wouldn't do it, because it would disturb things. And just like Krishna told Arjuna, you might be able to do something better, but it's better you do your duty, you know, even imperfectly, than to do another's duty, or take on another ashram or another varna and do it perfectly. Because it's not your role, it's not your duty, it's not your position. So we can apply the same principle here between men and women. Men and women have various roles. And so sometimes it just becomes a disturbance if the man tries to take on the woman's role or the woman tries to take on the man's role, unless there's some agreement in it and they decide it's better. So we're really talking here about what are the male roles and what are the female roles. And if the male does their part, then the female can do their part. And when the male doesn't do their part, then the females have a problem and they start to take on more male roles. And often it doesn't work or they're not happy. Now, sometimes women will be happy taking on a male role. A man may be happy taking on a female role, so that's fine. We're talking here general principle, and we're talking how we're trying to understand the seemingly inferior position that women were given, apparently, in Vedic culture. Even it seems that in some cases they were denigrated. But it's not really that way. When you study Vedic culture, you'll see that women were always highly respected. And women highly respected men. And the chastity between husband and wife was one of the ways they showed that respect. Because every time there's a good marriage, that helps all the other people who aren't married. How does it help them? Well, number one, it sets an example. And number two, that man and woman will have no business with any other man and woman. As we see, it's quite common today for men and women who are married to have affairs. And part of the reason, if not entirely the reason they have affairs, is because they're not dedicated to their husbands or wives. They're not chaste to their husbands or wives. So when people are in role, and one of the aspects of being in role is to be chaste to a husband and your husband or your wife, that helps everybody else. It helps you and it helps everybody. So in Vedic society, if a woman was married, men weren't looking at her, men weren't thinking, how can I get her? That thought wouldn't be there, because the family was such a tight unit. There was no question that would ever happen. In our society today, that happens all the time. Because the marriage institution is not strong. Kirtan has joined us. Welcome, Kirtan. Carol has a comment. Let me read the comment. She apologizes for being late. We will forgive you only this once. You know, there's a story, a devotee said, Prabhupada, if we fall down, will Krishna forgive us? And Prabhupada said, yeah, once, twice, three times, but not more. Then another time he said, I think he said something to, like, if Krishna doesn't forgive you, I'll forgive you. And if I don't forgive you, Radharani will forgive you. But, of course, don't take advantage of that. So Bhakti Carol says, or when the man falls away from his practices, what should the woman do? What are her responsibilities? I just read this morning. Now, we don't want to... I just read what Prabhupada said about this. And, you know, you have to apply it to your own situation. And he said that a woman really should not serve a man who has fallen. But then he said, if a man has fallen, that the woman has a right to separate from him, or vice versa, the man has a right. But he said, but don't get remarried. Don't separate and remarry again. So, of course, we would say, well, if a man has fallen, isn't the first thing you should do is try to help him become not fallen any longer? And yes, that's true. But the point Prabhupada's making is if he remains fallen, then the woman is not obliged to serve a man who's fallen, just like a disciple is not obliged to serve a guru who's fallen. So it's not sinful to leave such a man, but it would be sinful to remarry, at least ideally. Or I don't want to say it's sinful, but it wouldn't be proper. It's not what Prabhupada wanted, but Prabhupada did allow it because he saw that oftentimes we need that and it would help us, although he didn't really want it to happen. Okay, Anonymous is asking you a question. Well, where's Anonymous? Show me an Anonymous. Is
Anonymous.
Where's the question? Well, Anonymous, Hare Krishna, is masturbation, illicit sex, equal grievous offenses for the husband? I think what Prabhupada was referring to, a husband who's not following the principles of Krishna consciousness and particularly illicit sex, either with his wife or with another woman. With another woman, it's more serious. I don't think masturbation's cause for a woman to leave her husband, necessarily. And I mean, none of these things are necessarily causes for a woman to leave her husband, but what Prabhupada's saying is that if the husband is fallen and also negatively influencing the wife, that's a consideration. And I think the other point is that why should a woman serve a husband who's not a devotee or not acting like a devotee? That's not really her role. At least for a devotee woman, it's not her role to serve a husband who's not following the processes of Krishna consciousness. And then the question would be, well, what if the husband wants to engage in illicit sex, but only with his wife? Should the wife do that? And that's a whole other topic, which is better addressed privately. And we did talk a little bit about this previously. This is in a sensitive area, and there's so many ramifications to it. Of course, the textbook answer is no, but there may be sometimes exceptions. If that no can create other problems for the man, which may end up being more severe than engaging in illicit sex with his wife. Now, of course, there are also differences between those who've taken vows of initiation and those who haven't. And there's so many other circumstances to consider. So, if you want to talk more about it, then you'd have to email me. And you can email me at mahatmadasa@gmail. And then we could talk more about it. So, is there another question?
No.
Okay. Kirtan is talking about an initiation going on.
There's an initiation happening in Dallas at the moment.
Oh, nice.
For all those not watching your show.
Oh, that's why we don't have 400 people watching, because there's an initiation in Dallas. Oh, okay. So I don't feel so bad. Addictions can become sickness. Do we consider it not following, or do we consider it a sickness? That is a very good question, because then the wife has to ask herself, can I help my husband? Is it my duty to help him? And I would say it is your duty to help him if you can. And what will happen if I leave him? And so also the question is, what will happen if you stay? What are the pros and cons? So, you know, so generally we would say, stay and make it better. And but it may come to a point where it's so difficult for you, so troublesome, that in the long run it may be worse. And you may look at it and say, well, even though my husband has fallen, if I'm not with him, perhaps it would be even more difficult for me than being with him. And then I know eventually I can help him by staying with him. So these are all things to consider. That's a very good question. Thank you. So you're saying addictions like sexual addictions or drug addictions, alcohol addictions. And yet we need support to help break those addictions. So, you know, if a person has those addictions and they're willing to break them, then certainly the spouse is, the family is a support for that. And also, sometimes the support is, if you don't break it, I'm going to leave you. And that sobers them up. So it can work that way. I've seen. Okay, let's read a little more. Quite contrary to giving room for minimizing womanhood, Vedic literatures and culture give tremendous emphasis and importance to respecting them as highly valuable members of the society, even in this world, and as members deserving protection, just as the brahmanas, cows, children, and elderly deserve protection. An observant reader would not fail to notice this deep respect and importance given to women in the pages of Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. We find powerful statesmen and world emperors such as Arjuna and Maharaj Yudhisthira giving considerable time and deliberation to the special interests of the women in society and the irreparable social consequences of neglecting their needs. If it should be considered that those performing the role of housekeeping, raising and training God-conscious children, protecting family tradition and offering much needed support for the men constitute subordinate, unimportant roles, such as such an outlook reflects inequality. In fact, because we are relegating these most crucial services to a denigrated position. Wow! Did you catch that? He's saying that if we conclude that women who dedicate themselves to their husbands, to their homes, to raising children, to managing the affairs of the house, to raising children who are good citizens, good devotees, and so forth. If we say, well, that's a second-class position, or that's a subordinate position, then what are we saying? We are saying, well, those duties and those services that women do are less important than what men do. But that's not true. Isn't there a saying, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world? These are the women who are raising the great men and the great women who will become great leaders and influential people in the future. So I think that's an important point. That if we say this is a secondary, or they're in a secondary or subordinate position, that's the judgment we're making on the roles of motherhood and wifehood. And we're basically saying, well, the only way women will be considered equal or considered to be treated equal to men is that they have the same duties and job descriptions and roles within society. But just because we have the same roles wouldn't even mean we're equal. And as we're saying, it doesn't even mean it's better or proper. So, where am I? This is not the outlook of the Bhagavatam, for if it were so, there would not be such concern expressed for their welfare. By Krishna's natural arrangement, the female body is equipped to fulfill these roles, which demand in their own way as much competency, resourcefulness, and dedication as do the services traditionally assigned to men in a Vedic society. When the value of their roles is duly recognized and appreciated, competition for the latter's role or for the form of respect offered to them is rendered meaningless and unnecessary. Any man knows that his wife is better at running the house and taking care of the kids than he is. It's just the nature of women. They are intuitively understand or connected with what's best for their kids. That's just how they're wired. And they have more patience and tolerance in dealing with the kids in general. So they're suited for that role. It's natural. And I was just, I don't want to say where I was, but I was at a place where it's mostly men. And you could just go in there and you can tell there's no woman there. The way the house is laid out, the way the things were, and you just walk in and you think, they need a woman here to like straighten things up and get things looking better. So that's woman's nature. Wherever, any home they go to, it's going to look nicer generally than just a place where men are living. Where men are living, they'll have mismatched chairs and mismatched curtains and mismatched sofas and mismatch this and that, and it won't even bother them. Right, Mana? It won't bother them. And but when the woman comes around, it'll bother her and she'll make it nicer. So this is a natural role. I'm not saying all men are like that. Bhakti and Carol has a question. Why do they have to be equal? And who's saying women's role is less? That's the whole point. Why do they have to be equal? You know, it's like saying, you know, something, why doesn't this black cow give chocolate milk? You know, what's wrong with it? You know, no, it's not supposed to give chocolate milk. Or this animal does this, why doesn't the cow do the same thing? You know, the answer is obvious. That's the cow is created to give milk. It's not created to, like the bull. The bull has other, bull-like, you can till land with a bull. Bulls are strong, they like to work. They do so. They can pull an ox cart. They can pull a cart, and then it becomes an ox cart. So, you know, we're not going to sit around and argue, why are these cows sitting around eating grass and giving milk? Why aren't they pulling carts and plowing the fields? So it would be the same thing. You know? And why, who, like Carol's saying, who's saying that they have to be equal? Well, the problem is many women in today's society are saying that because they feel that they're being exploited. We were talking about that last week, and it's a very important point. In Vedic culture, there's a definite hierarchy, and the way the hierarchy maintains its sanity is because the superiors are taking care of the so-called superiors are taking care of the inferiors, and not even so-called superiors, like parents or gurus who are in a superior position. They're taking care of their dependents. So the system will only work when dependents are taken care of. So in this system that we're talking about now, when the man is taking care of the woman, it works. When he doesn't, then the woman is saying, step aside, you're not qualified, you don't deserve the position, the role, the honor that you're given because you're a bum. So I'm going to take over. So for this system to work properly, the men have to be men. And if the men are men, then the women can be women and everybody can live happily ever after. So, you know, I'm a man and sometimes I see women who want to be women and I just feel like saying, why do you want to be like a man? Men are jerks half the time. You have, you know, as a woman, you have so many good qualities. Don't give up that nature to try to compete with a man. You know, men can be cutthroat. And so then women enter the business arena and sometimes they become cutthroat like men, but that's not their nature generally to be that way. They're more sympathetic and compassionate and understanding and kind-hearted, and you know, they would rather often see to the welfare of another person even if they made less money. Where men are often a lot like that. So it's like, why do you want to be like a man in the certain ways that men can be very unsensitive? Okay. So Bhakti and Carol is saying, this evening it was brought to my attention that anything we do for the material needs is going to get reaction, even caring for physical needs of family members. How does this relate to women caring for family and home. I'm not sure what that means because it doesn't make sense to me. Anything we do for material needs, well,
in other words, it's not a Krishna conscious activity.
But if your material needs is if you're a devotee, then that's a Krishna conscious, that's Krishna, you know, if you're taking care of physical needs of yourself and your family and they're all devotees, that's Krishna conscious.
What if she's the only devotee in the family?
If you're the only devotee in the family, still, you have duty. You know, you can't, it's, as Prabhupada said, act in a way which is favorable to your bhakti. So if you're in that position for now, by your karma, by Krishna's arrangement, you're in that position. You have to do the best you can in that position to make the situation is Krishna consciousness as possible, unless it comes to a point where it's intolerable to deal with. But still, if you have children and you have responsibility, what can you do? You have to take care of them until they're adults, young adults. So, you know, we're speaking about women caring for family as a general principle, but even as a broader principle, that's their duty. And their duty, the woman's duty, is to keep the house pure, sattvic, spiritual. So the women engage in doing puja. They offer their food to Krishna, so everybody in the house eats prasadam. Everyone gets to see the deity, smell the incense. So that's part of their duty. So your duty would be then to spiritualize the home as far as you could, as far as possible. And then I wouldn't say that's a material duty any longer. But aside from it, even if what you some of the things you must do are so-called material, we still have responsibilities. We can't give up our responsibilities. At least not until we're older and everyone is well taken care of. But again, there may be specifics. I'm just speaking generally. So, can Krishna help one? Can KC help one to get off addiction? Yes, in most cases, or it depends on the severity of the addiction, it can, but it also requires understanding the principles of Krishna consciousness that can help cure addiction and applying them, because sometimes we understand the philosophy, but we don't understand how to apply it in a particular situation. So just like here in Alachua, on Sunday, I'm giving a class on sexual purity. And some of the men who are coming to this course will have some kind of addiction, for example, to pornography or to illicit sex or to masturbation or something. And everything that I'm going to teach is only things which they already know, but they don't exactly understand how it applies to their particular problem. So I have to take it out of its general philosophical context and apply it in its specific context to their problem. And then they'll see how to apply it. So sometimes that's difficult and you may need guidance and counseling. And then if the addiction is very severe, you may also need professional help.
As a follow-up.
Okay, so what else? Addictions can become sickness. Do we consider it not following, or do we consider it a sickness? Consider it both, but if you want to consider it a sickness first, and if we consider it a sickness and deal with it that way, and then take measures to deal with it, yes, because sometimes a person is helplessly addicted. I know a devotee was addicted to smoking cigarettes, and he'd go through phases of smoking, not smoking. And I said, well, why don't you just get professional help? And he never wanted to take it because he felt he could conquer it through Krishna consciousness, but he was never able to do that. So sometimes, if it really is a sickness, then we have to take measures to deal with it professionally because that's what it is. I mean, you know, many people have come to Krishna consciousness who are addicted to drugs and so many bad habits, and they overcame it through Krishna consciousness. So a lot also depends on the strength of one's Krishna consciousness. Some devotees are not that strong, and or their addictions are making it difficult for them to be strong, so they need other help. And if they could practice Krishna consciousness seriously and strongly, they may be able to overcome their addiction, but sometimes because of the addiction, they can't. And, you know, something like Alcoholics Anonymous or Sexaholics Anonymous, it's all based on spiritual principles of giving yourself over to the power of God and feeling yourself helpless to overcome your addiction without his power. So it's right in line with our philosophy. No devotee would have any trouble taking part in any of those programs if they needed it. And now here in Alachua, they're doing a 12-step program based on yogic principles. Do you know when that's going to be? Nanu? I don't know, but it's on the Alachua. It must be on the Raman Reti website, Alachua Temple website. So doing a yogic 12-step program, which is interesting, for devotees to deal with addictions. So let's see. Kremlin says, I'm a former counselor for the state. We find that following any faith has benefits if the person follows it. I had many KC in my practice. What? Devotees. You had many devotees in your practice. And you helped them through Krishna consciousness and other professional tools, I assume. Yeah. Because when we are overcome by addiction, we're powerless. And who's going to help us? And we're trying to fight it and we're losing the battle. So Krishna helps us. He empowers us. And that's how we do so many things in our life. Krishna empowers us. And this class I give on sexual purity, that's one of the basic principles. That Srila Prabhupada, he speaks in the Bhagavatam about how difficult it is to overcome sexual attraction, that even great yogis fall down, even great devotees have fallen down. That it's not something you deal with lightly if you want to practice any kind of sensual control. But specifically sexual control, you can't deal with it lightly and think, oh, this is easy. I don't have to worry about it. It's extremely difficult. It's so difficult that even great souls fall down. But at the same time, we understand the principle of Krishna consciousness is that by Krishna's mercy, difficult things become easy. And without Krishna's mercy, easy things become difficult. So overcoming addictions is possible when Krishna empowers the devotee, but Krishna won't empower the devotee unless the devotee gives himself over to that power and says, Krishna, I'm helpless, please. Do this for me. And that's not only true for addictions, but it may be true, not maybe true, but it is true. You can do that to be a better wife or a better husband or a better devotee or a better whatever. Say, Krishna, I need your help to do this. I don't know how to be a good father. I don't know how to be a good husband. I don't know how to be a good maintainer of my family. I don't know how to be a good teacher, a good counselor, a good devotee, a good this. Krishna, please. I turn this over to you. Please guide me. And then Krishna can use you and then by giving you intelligence and giving you the power and strength and determination to do what's necessary. And then you'll be much better at it than if you try to just push through on your own strength. Because you might have some ability on your own, but not as much as what Krishna is willing to give you. But the primary or foundational principle is that we have to want something, and then we show Krishna we want it, and then Krishna, he begins to act through us to help fulfill that desire, because Krishna's position is just to help us fulfill that desire. So if we want to become free from addictions or addictive behavior, Krishna can help us. But if we don't really want it, then it's not going to happen. We'll just be battling with it day after day, year after year. So there was one person who said that he was addicted to alcohol for many years. He finally overcame it. And he said every morning he's on his knees when he wakes up, just praying to God that he can be sober that day. And he's been sober for 40 years that way. He's just on his knees every day. Say, I'm helpless, please. So that's really, really the way we're supposed to live our lives in every way.
Our new visitor, RK from Atlanta.
RK. What does RK stand for?
She found out about it. notice from Facebook because I sent out an announcement on my
Facebook. Facebook, yeah. I should send one out too, shouldn't I? RK from Atlanta, welcome. Yes. So Kremlin says the first step is to acknowledge the problem, yes. And I think part of the fact of acknowledging means you want to do something about it. In class today, really interesting point came up. And we were talking about affluenza, you know, the addiction to having more, to buying more, to never be satisfied, never be satisfied. So a devotee was saying, well, what about our children? You know, they're being raised in this culture, which is telling them you don't have enough. And how can we help them? And you know, yeah, basically, how can we help them? So we were discussing different ways, and one devotee came up with a point. He said, you know, you don't really do anything if you don't want to. You don't do it just because you understand you should do it. You do it because you want to. So ultimately, if someone's going to give themselves to any kind of program to overcome addiction, they have to truly want it, not just like, well, let me try it, or, you know, it'd be nice if I wasn't addicted to this. But they have to truly want to live a life free from addiction, have actually a desire, a taste for it, so that therefore they can do what's necessary. Otherwise, you know, what's Alcoholics Anonymous about? 95% who do the program go back to drinking because it's so difficult and they just don't want it enough. And it's the same is true of Krishna consciousness. You have to want it because there's so many obstacles on the path of bhakti. You have to really want it. It's got to be something that you want, that you're actually attracted. This is attractive to you. This is what I really want. And one of the things Patanjali teaches, really interesting thing in dealing with the mind, he says if you have any kind of attraction or problem or addiction or obstacle, he said, just meditate on what it would be like or what it is like or will be like to not have it. So let's say in this context, in the context of the class I'm going to be giving, sexual problems, sexual attractions. So let's say a man or a woman is feeling very strong sexual attraction, or let's say a man is feeling a strong attraction for someone at the office, and he's feeling a stronger attraction to that woman than his own wife. So then at that point, he can think, according to Patanjali, how would I feel, would it be like if I had no attraction? You know, turn it around. What would it be like if I had no attraction for that? Then immediately can see how much better his life would be. And then begins to develop a desire. You know, this is really what I want. I really want chastity. I really want purity. So sometimes that can help us when we're addicted, or not even addicted, but just overly attracted to something that's not healthy for us, to visualize, imagine what my life would be without that attraction. And that can be a very powerful method to fire or nourish the desire to want to achieve that position. Because if we really have a taste for achieving that and think, yeah, I would really like to be that way, we're willing to do what we have to do. Okay, RK. Malati is here. Ravi is here. I don't even know where you're all from, but sometimes when you come on, why don't you tell us where you're from? Okay, so RK is saying, you may have discussed this, but for my sake, how to overcome this pornography and online videos, etc. My friend has a serious problem with overcoming in spite of association. There's a website, and I don't know the name, but what you could do is just Google sexual purity. And there'll probably be some website that'll tell you. I think it might be called covenanteyes.com. And so what this does is you choose somebody, a friend of yours, and I don't know technically how it works, but every time you view pornography, your friend can see that on his computer. That I don't think he sees the pornography, but he can see that you've gone to a site. So now your friend's aware, so you have someone to be accountable to. So every time that happens, he knows and he calls you and you talk about it. That's one way. Another way is they have Sexaholics Anonymous. And there are other programs, other websites. I would say when a devotee is in this position, they should do whatever they can. And again, they can do this meditation of visualizing what their life would be like without that, because they'll immediately realize how bad it is for them. Another meditation that I find helpful in terms of pornography is that what pornography is doing, and now you know that it's not just men watching pornography, it's 78% men, or 72%, but it's 28% women watching it. So, and it's, you know, it's just going to get worse. So the whole idea of pornography is when a person is looking at pornography, he's thinking how he can enjoy this woman. So there's no conception of relationship. There's no conception of responsibility. There's no conception of duty. There's no conception of romantic affection without sexual desire. It's completely self-centered. It's completely selfish. It's all about me. It's all about the person looking at it. And it's a fantasy world because that world doesn't exist. Number one, that world doesn't exist because women don't walk around for men. We were just reading this morning, there was this demon called Sankhasura, and he had a big jewel on his forehead, and he was really proud of that jewel. So he became really proud, and so he stole Krishna's wives because he thought he was so beautiful, they should be for him. So the reality is that women are not lined up for men to be their sexual slaves. So when a man's looking at pornography, that's what it is. A woman is like, has become his sexual slave. So it's about him and his sexual slave. So what that does is it undermines the value of woman, and it makes it more and more difficult for that man to have any kind of meaningful, balanced, holistic, loving, affectionate relationship with women. Because he's already put women into a particular relationship within his mind, that they exist for my enjoyment. And another problem that happens is if a man does that who's married, the women he's looking in these pornographic pictures are probably way more attractive than his wife. So it starts to disturb that relationship. It's already disturbing it because it's altering his perception of women. It's devaluing his relationship with them. It's changing his belief system about women to one that women are really meant for my enjoyment. And in the Shastra, we learn from the story of Krishna stealing the clothes of the gopis that if a man sees a woman naked, he has to marry her. So technically, every pornographic picture that a man looks at, technically, he has to marry that woman. So like these guys are probably should have like 400 wives by now who are looking at pornography. It said that 50% of the men in this world, that means one out of two men that you see walking down the street, view pornography at least once a month. It's a pretty sick situation. And that is it's like an acid in the heart. And what it does to the male-female relationship, it degrades the whole relationship. So what woman in her right mind would want to marry a man who's been viewing pornography since he was a teenager? Average age a kid first sees pornography is 11. So ladies, you want to marry a guy who's been looking at pornography at least once a month since he was 11? I don't think so. How do you think he's going to deal with you? You think he's going to be chaste, a chaste husband? It's going to be really hard for him. That's what he's bringing into the marriage. So every time a man views pornography, he's undermining his marriage or he's undermining his potential marriage. If he's not married, he's undermining the relationship he's going to have with his wife because he's implanting all these samskaras about women as objects for his sexual enjoyment. And another realization I had about pornography is that in Vedic culture, it is said in traditional Vedic culture, when women went out, they went out in palanquins, which had curtains on all sides, and nobody saw them. So in strict Vedic culture, men didn't really even see women. They only saw their mother, their sister, or their wives. So then we advance it a little further, so men are seeing women, and women don't really dress like they did in Vedic culture. So, okay, it's not that bad. But for men to see other women than their wives naked, that is like, it's like unheard of in the history of the, you know, of the world up until the invention of the printing press, or, you know, in some degraded societies. But for men in general, as widespread as today, it's unheard of. It's just not the way God didn't create us to see other people without clothes. Prabhupada said that is total animal life. So the message for men, you can give this message to your friend, is viewing pornography. According to Prabhupada, that is what animals do. It's not what humans do. Prabhupada said human beings are meant to cover their bodies. So if you're looking at a body that's not that's uncovered, you're not a human being. Also, Prabhupada said, no cultured man would ever want to look at a naked woman. And the example is given that Draupadi was being, her sari was being torn apart. So what cultured, there were no cultured men there. No, the men weren't protesting. So Prabhupada's point is no cultured man would allow that to happen. And if the sari were pulled off, no cultured man would have looked at her. They would have turned away. And now we have the exact opposite. Instead of turning away, we're viewing pictures of naked women one after another. And it's all these impressions are going in the hearts of men, and it's making it difficult for them to be husbands, to be boyfriends. It's just, it's like the worst thing. So I would say in whatever way they can get help. And of course, Krishna consciousness is the ultimate solution for purity. But sometimes these addictions require more work. And as a friend, you can really do something to help them. And, you know, Sexaholics Anonymous is wonderful. And there's so many other programs. Malati used to live in Gainesville, now in Tampa. Oh, Ravi, Birmingham. In England, so in England, oh my God, you're up late. In England, it's 3 a.m, right? Wow. Ravi, I was with Tribhuvanath Prabhu for many years. Amazing. Kremlin, you mentioned the book last week, Every Man's Battle. Yes, that's another book. It's a Christian book called Every Man's Battle, and this was a book written by two Christian men who grew up in a home in which their father was viewing pornography. It was like all over the place, so they got to see it. And I was thinking about this book today, and excuse me, let me go backtrack. This book is about how they grew up addicted to pornography as Christian men, as good Christian men, so-called, as married men, and their battle dealing with their lust. Not only just addicted to pornography, but just addicted to sexual lust. And then, you know, I was thinking about this book today, and I was thinking, when I grew up, all the messages I got growing up were to enjoy women. From my friends, from society, from my father, it was like there's something wrong with you if you're not thinking that way. So growing up that way is a real challenge for us who are practicing Krishna consciousness to practice sexual control. Because the whole, you know, we grow up and your parents and are telling you, you're really a handsome young boy. You're really a pretty young girl. You should be able to attract a lot of girls. I bet the girls really like you, don't they? I bet they fall all over you. Yeah, go out and get them, you know. Don't you have a girlfriend? Don't you have a boyfriend? So you're getting all these messages. And then you consider that success if you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend when you're 13 years old. Oh, I guess I'm doing the right thing. And you want to learn whatever you have to learn about sex as soon as you can. So now statistics say that half the 15-year-olds have already had sex. So, you know, this is what we're dealing with. And then the thousands of sexual messages that we're getting through the media, subtly or grossly. So, Krishna Priya is here. Welcome, Krishna Priya. Okay. Great topic. Good issues like this are discussed. Great, hard ones to crack. Yeah, we have to talk about it. Yeah, there are two men that wrote that book, Every Man's Battle. And I've heard them talk about it. And it's interesting because they were able to conquer their addiction, but it took a while. It took them months and months and months, but they were able to conquer it. And they really worked on it, and they could do it. And so we can do it also. And many people are dealing with these problems, and they're doing it. So, Anonymous, if I would like to ask a few personal questions, what would be the best way that you can email me? So, yeah, email me, mahatmadas@gmail. That would be good. And then if we need to talk on the phone, we can go from there. And if you'd like to come to Alachua, it's going to be nice weather this week. On Sunday from 9:30 to 3:30, we're going to do a sexual purity seminar for men, which is a really wonderful seminar where we talk about these topics. And if you want to come, just email me. Get on the first bus, train, or plane out here. We will reserve your seat. And we'll have a wonderful time. And it's amazing. I've only done this once, but that one afternoon of 4 or 5 hours made significant difference in the lives of the devotees who attended that seminar. It's powerful. There are a lot of powerful tools in Krishna consciousness that can help us. So Bhakti Carol said, you said animal-like. Several days ago, a taxi driver was taking me to the temple. He was somewhat familiar with the temple, but he didn't like what he had heard. He said to me that avoiding sexual relationships except to produce children is more like animals than engaging in relationships. Because animals only have sex during mating season. He mentioned cats and dogs, which have physical relations only at times to produce children. I didn't know what to say to him. And I'd never heard that argument. I've never, ever heard that. Well, of course, our argument is that God created sex. Well, you know, this is the problem you're dealing with, is that Christians are very strict about abstinence before marriage. But after marriage, they are not strict about it. In fact, they teach that after you're married, you should enjoy sex to the fullest. Just don't do it before you're married, but do it after you're married and enjoy it because, you know, God made it for you to enjoy. So that's where his question's coming from. It's hard for him to understand it. Why would God want you to abstain from something that's so enjoyable? Now, according to yogic philosophy, unnecessary indulgence in sex weakens the body, weakens the mind, weakens the spirit. It's just not good for you in any way. And Prabhupada talks about determination through celibacy. And even Patanjali talks about it also, and how a person becomes very powerful through celibacy and becomes a powerful speaker and able to influence others. And Prabhupada said, do you know why everyone wants to touch my feet? Because everywhere Prabhupada would go, people would want to touch his feet, at least in India. And he said, they want to touch my feet because I have no sex desire. So we understand it as the ultimate in self-discipline and self-control. And we also want to produce children who are elevated. And the only way we can produce children who are elevated is to elevate our consciousness and conceive of a child in an elevated state, not in a state of sexual or lustful enjoyment for the sake of enjoyment. I mean, you know, we can't expect everyone's going to understand this. They're not trained to understand it. Yes, RK, try to help. And if you need any help on my part, I can also help you, and I can put you in touch with other devotees who've gone through sexual therapy who could help you. So Ravi's up late preparing a course. Oh, what course are you preparing? For devotees, non-devotees? Carol says days.
She's just correcting spelling.
Oh, spelling. Okay. Sagar from Krishna House. Yes, Sagar. Welcome, Sagar. Bhakta Sagar. Glad to have you here. One more question. RK is asking another question. Okay. Wow, it's 9/11. Time flies when you talk about sex, huh? Okay. That's funny. I downloaded some, you know, anytime the word on the internet comes, sex comes up, then it's like sometimes you can't get an email through with that word. And in Krishna consciousness, we talk about it all the time. It's kind of unusual, isn't it? Or interesting. One more question may sound raw and crude, but I found this to be a realistic issue. What if a man cannot see a motherly love or a woman as woman, but sees them as lusty, beautiful character and only sees them exciting for sex? How to change this consciousness? I did not succeed so far. Well, that, you've got to send them to my seminar, or we have to do some counseling. What we have to do is, you have to understand that men growing up in this culture have been programmed to see women that way. So that's one of the biggest challenges for men.
And the women have been programmed to portray that.
Yeah, so the women have been programmed to portray that, even if they don't know that they're programmed to portray it, by the way they behave and the way they dress.
By the role models they try to emulate.
Or the role models they emulate, yeah. Like, for example,
Christina Aguilera or whatever.
Yeah, we don't mention names, but, you know, all the popular rock stars who are on the borderline of porn stars when they perform.
All of our girls want to dress like them.
They set the fashion trend, so you want to dress that way. And then, you know, 100 years ago, people would go to the beach and they would be covered head to toe. Now people go to the beach in their underwear. I mean, we don't call it underwear, but basically it's underwear. So, you know, a man is raised in that culture where the women dress in a very attractive way. And a man has been programmed to see women as an object of his sex enjoyment. I mean, look at those car commercials where the sexy lady's laying over the car. So you think, if I buy the car, I get the lady. Or if I smoke the cigarette, I get the lady. Or I wear the perfume, I get the lady. What does he want the lady for? To work from 7 in the morning to 7 at night for her? No, he wants to have sex with her. And when he's finished having sex with her, he wants to have sex with another one. Prabhupada said that. He said, men are not satisfied with one woman. They want to enjoy with many women. So Krishna consciousness is a culture to subdue that tendency. So if a man doesn't have Krishna consciousness, then he's conditioned to see women based on a deeply seated belief that women are meant for his sexual enjoyment. That's why they exist. That's their prime function. They may exist for other functions, but that's one of the most important functions. And some women exist only for that function, such as prostitutes, such as women in pornographic literature or at topless bars. They only exist for one purpose, for his gross sexual satisfaction. And in his mind, many women only exist for that purpose. So that's what you're dealing with. And so the Vedic paradigm is women are mother, to see women as this loving, nurturing, the emblem of love, affection, nurturing. And therefore, we respect women, we honor them, we serve them. But men don't see women, always see women in that honoring aspect. It's because when you see them in the honoring aspect, you would not want to have sexual thoughts. It's when we don't honor them. If a man is viewing pornography, he's not honoring those women at all. He's making them, in his mind, their sexual slaves. What men do is they imagine, I don't know, women may do this also, but men imagine sex in their mind. They see a beautiful woman and they imagine embracing her, or they imagine having sex with her, because that's the conditioning. They don't look at that woman and think, here is a mother, how can I serve her? They think, oh, she's beautiful, I like to embrace her. I like to take her home and enjoy her. And after I enjoy her, I don't really care, you know, what she does or what happens to her. So that is the basic mentality of men, and then society feeds it. So therefore, in Vedic culture, the idea is men are trained as brahmacharis, so it counteracts that tendency, and they're trained to see women as mother, to respect them. So they have now a really good chance of subduing their sexual desires. But when they're not trained that way, and what to speak of being programmed the way we are, that's what they're dealing with. So you don't want to have a relationship with a man who sees you as just an attractive instrument for his sense gratification. It's going to end in a big mess. And then Prabhupada said, he said very clearly, a man and woman get married to enjoy sex, and when there's no more sex enjoyment, when they can't enjoy sex any longer, they get divorced. He says that's the basis of their relationship, because that's the basis of their conditioning. And now people don't want to get married, they just want to live together, because that way it's just easier to deal with it. You can enjoy it and leave it. So basically there's this irresponsible sex thing going on, you know. Can I do it and get out of it and move on to somebody else? So that's, you know, women, what is Veda culture? Man is trained to be brahmacharya and a woman is trained to be devoted to her husband. That solves the problem right there, those two things. You just do that, you solve that whole problem that we're faced with in society today. And that's why Prabhupada said, what does marriage mean? It means the woman gets married at 8, she gets trained up how to take care of her husband. When she reaches puberty, they move together and they have children. And you look at that and go, well, that is so, so primitive, so antiquated, so barbarian. But actually, if you really study it in the light and context of everything we're talking about, you see that actually solves the whole problem. Man is brahmacharya, woman is chaste wife. There's a relationship, it lasts for life. Hey, that rhymed. Somebody write a song. Okay, so first we're going to say Ravi is doing a course for non-devotees, small charities and business, teaching them to create their own videos. Oh, good. Yeah, I need a video also. Maybe we can talk about it. Okay, Sagar says, it's interesting, in America people are programmed this way, but in India, externally we don't see women this way, but internally there is lust due to influence of Western ideas. Yeah, totally. It's India, you're so far ahead of it, and now you're opening yourself up to the media of the West, and you're just like chopping at your foundation. And so all the problems that we're having in the West, you have just invited into your culture. You've opened your arms and embraced them, and you don't know what you're doing. In 10, 15 years from 20 years from now, you're going to start dealing with it, and you're going to realize, oh my God, we embraced Western culture indiscriminately, and we pulled in all the bad. I mean, it's such a valuable thing. You know, Indian culture, sometimes you don't even see your wife till the day you get married. You pull the veil, and that's the first time you see her. As you can imagine in the West doing that, that's like impossible. You know, you pull the veil and go, oh, sorry, not this one. Let's try it again, you know. It'd be like gambling or something. And you can do that in Indian culture because of training and live happily the rest of your life, because you're not thinking, well, you know, this whole relationship is based around my sexual attraction to this woman or her attraction to me. But it's much deeper than that. Responsibility, dharma is there. So that's a very good point. So Indians like us might respect women very nicely and open, but in our own quarters we have lusty desires. Yeah, yeah. Young college kids in India are as bad or worse today in this area of sexuality than they are in the West. And the thing is, whenever society restricts something, they have to be able to restrict it on deeper levels. And if they only restrict it externally, but they don't restrict it on deeper levels, it often gets worse. It's often worse than in a society which just allows it on all levels. And I was reading something about this recently, and how this often creates a greater problem, because there's no it's like, you know, when there's like, it's somehow not as bad when it's, there's less cultural restriction, because it's almost like you can regulate yourself more easily. But when you're so much restricted, it's almost like the analogy of the rubber band. It's just pulled back. And so when you're on your own and you find some way to express yourself, the rubber band just cracks. Because there has to be education behind why you're doing something. There has to be cultural support to why you're doing it. Otherwise, it doesn't work. So Ravi is going to get back to his work. And yeah, I mean, I love Indian culture, and it's so sad to see what's happening. Because Indians have so much, and they can, it's so easy for them to adopt that culture and do it. But their propaganda is that this is all backwards. It's an antiquated culture. We have to become modern, and in becoming modern, it's just going to become as degraded as everyone else in the world. But Indians have the potential, and many still are, to be very spiritually elevated.
Should we support the Taliban?
One
of the reasons they quote the Taliban quotes why they bombed the Americans is because we're degrading their
culture. Oh yeah, we're degrading. The Taliban bombed us because we're degrading their culture. It's true, we are. I don't know if they should bomb us because we are, but I think Americans should understand why they would want to bomb us because we are. You know.
Satellite TV is degrading people in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I was in Mauritius, and one of our main members there was saying how the country had recently become degraded because of satellite television and all the American programs. If you look at the media, just look at any magazine, TV shows, cartoons, talk shows, and you just really look at it from the point of view of the cultural values that are coming grossly or subtly through the dialogue, through the visuals, through the messages, and really look at it, it'll scare you to death to see what's happening. And you know, if you're open and honest. And sometimes we're not open and honest about it. We don't realize how much we're being affected by it. But if we're open and honest about it, we'll see how difficult these things are making our lives when we allow ourselves to associate with them. If you're going to watch movies, you're going to listen to radio, you're going to watch TV, you're going to read newspapers and magazines, you're going to get this programming. It's all coming through it. Consciousness is coming through the music. Like we say, consciousness comes through food when people cook. Eat in restaurants, the consciousness of the people cooking is coming through. You listen to the music. Their consciousness is coming through the music. You look at art, the person's consciousness is coming through the art. It's all going on. You associate with people. Even if they don't talk, you're being affected by their thought, their waves, their energy. It's all there. And then sometimes we just feel spiritually weak and we wonder why. Well, you know, look, what magazines were you looking at? What messages were there subtly? What was in the picture? Prabhupada even said, if you look at Newsweek magazine, you'll see the faces of these politicians and become polluted because so many of these politicians are so dishonest and so corrupt that just by seeing their faces, you become polluted. And I'm sure you've probably felt that subconsciously, or if not consciously, sometimes looking at the faces of certain world leaders, you just look at them and you feel uneasy. You feel that this person is a bad person. So the face is the index of the mind. When you see somebody pure, you feel pure. You feel good. So you don't have to be very careful about what we're being influenced, what we allow ourselves to be influenced by, particularly if we want to maintain any kind of regulated spiritual practice and self-control and discipline. You really have to live a bit in a vacuum from society, because this society is going down and everybody is in this. Even people who are more in sattva gun, still, you can't be perfectly in sattva gun because the society is so passionate and ignorant. So even the so-called sattva gun people you see are often very sexually crazed, mesmerized by it, because that's the pervasiveness of it in our culture. So, it's Kali Yuga, these things are set to happen. Yeah, we have sex, money, drugs, gambling, that's Kali Yuga. So thank you all for listening. We've gone over time, but I guess it was worth it. And we will have more interesting discussions next week, and we'll tell you a little bit about the Sexual Purity Seminar if you didn't come, what realizations we had. And same time, same station next week. Hare Krishna.